Mühlerhaus meeting, Sunday, 24th September, 1978. At our meeting yesterday, we read those words of Jesus in St. John's Gospel, chapter 12, verse 24, embodying a profound truth. Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat falls into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it dies, it bringeth forth much fruit. Later on in the same Gospel of St. John, chapter 12, verses 49 and 50, Jesus says, "For I have not spoken on my own authority." The actual translation is "of myself." But the Father which sent me, he gave me a commandment what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that his commandment is life everlasting. And it was through that commandment from the supreme source that Jesus said the words, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit." And Jesus goes on, "Whatsoever I speak, therefore, even as the Father said unto me, so I speak." Which means that Jesus speaks out of the profoundest depth of consciousness that it is possible for any person to realize whilst living on earth. And in chapter 15, verse 15, he says, "For all things that I have heard of my Father, I have made known unto you." There is nothing which is kept back, which is secret from his personal disciples, the 12. He does not say all these things to the multitude, but to those who were dedicated to him, including Judas. We regard Judas as a traitor. Was he a traitor? The word traitor is used in the English language. But in the French translation, the word used is not betrayed, it's delivra, delivered. And if you meditate on this, you will see a completely new meaning to that whole wonderful supreme drama at the end of the life of Jesus. Jesus himself dips the sop and gives it to Judas. And at that moment of transmission, a supreme archetypal power takes possession of Judas and enables him to carry out his destined mission. Outwardly, it seems as if he was the instrument of the murder of Jesus. Was he? Consider carefully. Could the Son of God have triumphed except for the action of the son of doom, which Judas was? So, when we come across truth which sears the soul, because it is so terrible, let us not be afraid of it. Let us not try to run away from it. And let us not face it in the spirit of determined opposition to discover its inner meaning. Because any sort of opposition, any sort of escape, prevents us from being the instruments through which that truth comes to life in us. And in that coming to life, that truth transforms the world. That truth is the teacher, the instrument, and all of us are learners. In the act of learning, we confer masterhood, teacherhood, upon the person through whom came the message and the inspiration. That is why the true teacher, the true Mahatma, never openly advertises that he is the teacher. He is the server. And yesterday it was mentioned that when we are free of the illusion of ourselves as being a permanent ego, as an entity which is identifiable through endless time, there is a remarkable transformation of our mode of consciousness. Our ordinary worldly consciousness is primarily concerned with self-preservation. This is the drive we inherit because of our bodily evolution from an animal ancestor. It is right and proper for the animal to obey the law of his own being. And that law, as one part of its expression, consists in living unto himself for self-preservation. That is correct for the animal. And at our animal level, especially when we are little children, it is correct and proper that we draw the world unto ourselves in order that we may grow to bodily maturity. After that, there comes a great difference. Associated with this drive is the passion to satisfy all the desires which arise out of the animal side of our psychophysical organism. Out of the animal side only. For example, the pleasures of the senses, the satisfaction of our ambitions and cultural pursuits, our lust for possessions and power, the passion to dominate others, to be an oppressor. And we are oppressors because within ourselves, we ourselves are slaves, not free men. He who is a truly free man enslaves nothing and nobody. Our self-centered pursuit of spiritual goals. This is a very difficult point. So many of us will sincerely and honestly, but mistakenly believe that we are dedicated to God, to the highest, to what is the truly worthy. But if we look sufficiently deeply into our nature and the workings of the inner aspects within our consciousness, we will see that the self is attempting to grasp God, to grasp that which is divine for oneself. There is a subtle element of self-glorification involved in it. Remember that statement which comes in all the great religious teachings. Before the soul can stand in the presence of the Supreme, it must be completely naked, stripped of everything which is of the nature of separate selfness, stripped of everything. And that word everything has to be taken in its literal meaning. All these pursuits born of the animal side of our nature are egoistic. Our worldly mode of consciousness seeks to draw the world unto our own ego and to hold the world, the external environment, in bondage to this ego. Again, because we are not free. So each of us is like a dangerous whirlpool which sucks up and destroys that everything that comes near it and disturbs the peaceful, beautiful and blissful flow of the river of life. You remember how Homer in the Odyssey presents that voyage of Odysseus after the Trojan War back to his old home and all the adventures he has to go through. You remember at one point he passes between Scylla and Charybdis, the whirlpool. It's a very instructive epic poem, the Odyssey, just as the Iliad is instructive. When we truly see that this ego is not a permanent entity, but is like a bubble which vanishes into sheer nothingness when pricked by the point of unerring insight, by wisdom, then our consciousness turns inside out. Instead of constantly looking within into ourselves and functioning solely for the sake of ourselves, it opens out like a bud which opens out and becomes the perfect bloom. Then it gives joy. It gives the perfume of life by its very existence. And by its process thereafter of fading away altogether, completely dying. No clinging to its original state of the bud, no clinging to its completely flowered state as the perfect bloom. And that is one of the supreme meanings and examples of sacrifice, which means to make sacred. In other words, through living the perfect life, beautiful, and relinquishing it all the time and completely at the right time, you have sanctified your own life and you have sanctified the world around you, even though the world may be quite blind to it outwardly. But inwardly, the consciousness of man undergoes change, and tremendous change, because you have changed in your innermost depths, from which flow the springs which influence the life of all mankind. Our consciousness, therefore, turns inside out, no longer self-enclosed, self-centered, imprisoned. It opens out to the infinite, to the whole reality or actuality, to the holiness of truth, to the immortal. Then we cease to be whirlpools, and we flow in harmony with the singing, dancing waters of life. We, as we are at this moment, are worldly, feeling and thinking creatures. Our thinking is the servant of our self-centered feelings. Intellect is the slave of animal-originated desire. Watch this very carefully in our own lives, how we direct our intellect, to what purposes. Watch it in the lives of the mass of human beings who live not as a united human family in love and cooperation, but in conflict, in disorder, in fear and suspicion, as the nations of the world and their history prove conclusively. So, we cannot commit ourselves to the religious life, that is, the pure and truly human life. We make the great mistake because our vision is so limited, of separating the religious life from the secular life in the world of affairs. Where else can we live religiously, excepting in the everyday life in the world? It's no use retreating forever, for the rest of our days, I mean, therefore, or seeking a refuge from the troubles of everyday life in a monastery or in a cave. By all means, go to the monastery, go to the cave, learn what there is to be learned there, but you have to come back into the world. Otherwise, one has failed to bear, to love all mankind in that remarkable spirit, that deep aspect of love which suffers with the sufferings of mankind for their sake, which looks on at all the evil doing going on without hating it. Because if we hate it, if we react against it, we are split personalities. We are not whole. It is only the whole person, the holy person, who out of the transcendent depths of his own being sends out that influence which heals. Ordinary mortals only produce a counteraction, which means conflict, or they produce some soothing palliative, which is merely a dope, an anesthetizer. So we must learn not to seek to live the religious life in order that our sorrow, our personal sorrow, our personal difficulties may be soothed and our problems solved. Not in that spirit. That way it always comes back to us. For no true healing, whole making, release of holiness can take place at the level of the disease. It is from a transcendent depth that healing comes, and it is healing that individuals and the whole of mankind need, not counteractions, not schemes and plans to replace a system which is unsatisfactory. How can my imperfect mind be so self-conceited as to think that the system that I produce is going to be a panacea for the ills of the world? If that really were possible, surely it could have been done thousands of years ago. Because the intellect of man thousands of years ago was not inferior to our intellect today. So, we cannot commit ourselves to the religious life, the pure and truly human life. But, through constant mindfulness, the psyche becomes purified. Constant mindfulness. Samasati, to use the Pali term, watch and pray as Jesus. They are the identical teaching. Through constant mindfulness, then the psyche becomes purified, and then consciousness is liberated from selfness. our isolative self-consciousness ceases to be isolated. We are no longer separate from our brotherhood. You, whoever you are another version of me, myself. I, myself, am another version of you. We are one mankind, manifested in a multitudinous variety of ways. But we are all human, born in bondage, in ignorance, in suffering, but with the potentiality of the supreme liberation into true manhood. And insofar as the individual is liberated into true manhood, that individual is a power to change all mankind. Then, quite naturally and spontaneously, we live the holy life. Naturally and spontaneously. Not by compelling ourselves, not by conflicting with ourselves within, in order to drive us, to force us into living what we, with our imperfect intellects, picture as the holy life. Be quiet, be silent inside. Watch the turmoil. That will produce the silence. No compulsive effort to be silent will produce that transcendent silence which includes all sound. The whole silence includes the noise, a cacophony which has to be transmuted into a harmony. A polyphony by us. So, naturally and spontaneously, we live the holy life, and then we cannot avoid being totally committed, wholly dedicated to transcendence. When we cease to strive, and it is transcendence which does the work, inspiring, sustaining, giving us the power of that pure life, which is the divine life. And it's an extraordinary thing that in all the religions of the world, one of the supreme attributes of one of the greatest attributes of the Supreme is life everlasting. This means that transcendence, or God, use any word you like, lives and functions freely in us. God reaps the full harvest of the sowing to which each one of us, purified and egoless, contributes. Unto God the glory. Sri Krishna in the Gita says, perform thou action as service unto me, not for the sake of the self. And that contribution is wholly inspired by transcendence. How easily people who try to live religiously make the curious mistake of saying that they had this, that, and the other particular communication from God Himself. God God doesn't speak our languages. The transcendent doesn't function in terms of our petty thinking and feeling, which entirely belongs to the finite, perishable, mortal sphere. That which comes out of the infinite, imperishable, immortal sphere is an influence which has no language. We cannot know it. We shouldn't try to know it and formulate it, because we can only formulate it in our imperfect terms, and therefore we go wrong. Let it influence us without trying to know it. Do not pry into that which is supremely holy. Remember again Jesus' words, give not that which is holy unto the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample upon them, and then turn and rend you also. You see how profound and significant are such statements. This inspiration by transcendence does not spring out of our petty feelings and thoughts. See in all this one of the very deep meanings of the word karma, which we translate in our petty terms like the Newtonian idea of action and reaction are equal and opposite. This is one infinitesimal aspect of the working of karma. Our conception of we reap as we sow is again a petty infinitesimal fraction of the workings of karma, this seesaw balancing process. If you bear in mind that karma is creative activity, which my brain can never compass, and leave it at that, it will slowly influence the deeps of consciousness and effect a wonderful transformation which will help the complete opening out and flowering of consciousness. What then happens with feeling and thought? Our feeling and our thinking. All feeling is transformed into divine compassion. All thought into divine wisdom. We will never know the form of it because it is transcendent, but we will be affected by it. This is then expressed in all our particular feelings as the all-inclusive infinity of friendship, of loving kindness, of compassion, of sharing the sorrows and joys of our fellow human beings, and ourselves remain well poised within. It is expressed in all our perceptions of the true nature of all our daily experience, ourselves remaining free of all reactions of greed, hate, and fear, whilst we ourselves remain well established in truth, which is not darkened by fixed dogmas, doctrines, beliefs, and concepts. Fixed dogmas and doctrines. It's the fixation which is the ill state. Concepts and so on will inevitably arise, in the living process. Let them go. Don't grasp them. They will have their use at the time and place when they occur, and when they have expended their life energy in promoting your growth and fulfillment, don't hold on to them. Otherwise, you are stagnating. Something like this is this change of consciousness. The transmutation of the worldly mode of awareness into the transcendent mode of awareness of all existence. It is the self-shining sign proclaiming the good news that you, the pure, true human, through whom transcendence manifests itself in the archetypal, glorified form of perfect manhood. This is the true meditative state. Meditation is not a technique, a method to practice. Just as each of us here is in a living state because life energy is active psychophysically in our organism, our whole being and consciousness, purified of all evil, perfectly free, lives in the meditative state of constant creativity, of unbroken unity with and in transcendence. Mindfulness is your individual technique and practice which enables the living, transpersonal, beyond personality and impersonality, that is, transpersonal meditative state to supervene. Mindfulness is in time and space, finite and mortal. It is your task. In its perfection and complete fruition, it grows and becomes identical with meditation, which is infinite, eternal, immortal. Our English word meditation has considerable drawbacks in representing the Sanskrit word samadhi. The Sanskrit word samadhi is not meditation as ordinarily understood. It is not confined to the practice of concentration, holding the mind fixed on a particular subject of thought. It is not that. Samadhi is the supreme togetherness, the state of absolute unification in the unity which is the total universe. And this is a state of being. It is not a technique. It is the ultimate reality living freely through you, the finite mortal, the great miracle of life. You are the mortal caretaker of the finite temple, which is your living organism. Keep it pure. Then transcendence is the meditator in that divine temple, not built with hands, and you yourself, the beloved child of God, or another light of the world. And so we come to the close of another autumn school in Elmore. We come to the end of its external form, but we go on as this school and that school of life, which is the school of the whole world. The form has to be relinquished, but that life which is generated and comes to some sort of fulfillment in this particular form goes on, and in due time, in the ripeness of circumstance, releases the new form through which it will express itself. We have been very fortunate here in this lovely valley, which in its superb moments is like heaven itself. There is such peace and such a drenching of its whole being with the love and the wisdom of the divine. It is easy enough to enter into the depths and realize things which we do not realize in the stress and strain, the battle, as we call it, of life in the world of bustle and hustle, the world of the conflict of ambitions, the world of the fears and anxieties of ordinary existence. But be of good cheer. That is the way of life in our modern age. That is our school. It is there that we are tested in the fire of the struggle and the suffering we have to go through, and which we, because we are still imperfect, cause to those around us. Be mindful, be watchful, try and be awake to the fundamental unity of all things. In that unity in which everything that we experience is held in a transcendent harmony. We have a wonderful teacher of supreme truth in Western music. Music which is created by the movement, the simultaneous movement of different voices, as we call them, different parts, each of which sings its own song, commingles in a certain manner at times, which, if allowed to remain like that, is a discord, but which, through the skill of the creative musician, flows out and commingles again in what we term concords. And so on till the symphony comes to its final denouement and the symphony is over. And this movement of different parts mingling in positions of discord and also in positions of concord afterwards, and again in discords, and again in concords. It is that in its wholeness which constitutes the harmony. Harmony doesn't mean merely pleasant sounds. It means the integrating of every sound, which is a symbolical message of this, that, and the other aspect of the divine itself. It's the integrating of all that into one great whole, and our completely accepting and understanding and living in that whole with unself-conscious attention and inner quietness. Then you know real happiness. So, one of our tasks at least, when we go back into the ordinary world, as we call it, will be so to be awake to the wholeness of that living process, that ourselves function happily as a great harmony. And that is the happiness I would like to wish all of you. Take that spirit with you into the world. Infuse the world with that spirit. And keep it in your hearts. Overriding everything is this power of divine love. And I cannot do better than remind you of that wonderful discourse by that great Upanishadic teacher, Yajnavalkya, who was called the Prince of Yogis. It comes in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. And it opens with the statement that Yajnavalkya now decides that he will leave life in the outer world as such altogether and go away without any possessions whatsoever. So he gives away his goods. He wants to give away his goods, and his goods, of course, can be counted on one's fingers' ends, to his wife. But his wife is a true mate to him. And she says, "Now, sir, would I be immortal if I possessed all your goods?" "Oh no," says Yajnavalkya, "your life will be the life of those who possess goods. Through possessing goods or riches, there is no immortality." So Maitreyi, his wife, and Maitreyi means love, that's the meaning of that name, says to Yajnavalkya, "I have no use for these goods. Teach me what you know so that one may realize immortality." And then comes the marvelous discourse. The wording is so simple that it escapes our grasping it. He starts off by saying, "Not for the sake of the love of the husband is the husband dear. But for the love of the Atma, the Supreme, the Absolute, is the husband dear. Not for the love of the wife is the wife dear. But for the love of the Supreme is the wife dear. And he goes on in that strain, mentioning children, friends, honors, possessions, and all the rest of it. And ends up by saying, not for the sake of the whole world, and all the worlds. And in this context, the word worlds means states of consciousness, the deep states of consciousness particularly, are the worlds dear. But for the sake of the love of the Supreme are all these dear. And then he says that one of the most significant things in that whole discourse. He says that if that love of the Supreme is absent, then all these, husband, wife, children, goods, possessions, honors, dignities, they all fall away. It is transcendent love which holds all in a divine, unified harmony. And if that burns like an eternal flame within us, then all the sorrows and joys of the world will just come and go. Will come and go through us and enrich the world through our realization of the love of the Supreme. Let that spirit, if you like, permeate our lives as we go our separate ways. Lastly, thank you for allowing me to try to serve you. I am your servant, your free servant, your obedient servant. Obedient meaning he who listens to the needs of others. Thank you.